Very exciting shiur. We spent 3 weeks chronicling the life of the first Jew, the first monotheist, the discoverer of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Avraham Avinu. And we spoke about his transformation from Avram to Avraham. We spoke about the Mila challenge and whether identifying yourself as a Jew precludes you from being a universalist or enhances your universalism. Bris Mila, the challenge of the Akedah to operate in a world in which you can't understand HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon. Or just please move the chair to the side. Thanks. And then last week we spoke about the great balancing act, thank you, of Avram and his ability to shift from the public sphere and the grand stage of history to the quiet home of Chayasara. And now we've arrived at the second titan, the second Shlomo. You got to take a sheet. Guys are coming, you got to take a sheet from the back table. The second titan, the second hero of Sefer Bereishis, the second of the three, Yitzchak Avinu. And now we can roll up our sleeves and get into Yitzchak's life and Yitzchak's paradigm shifts and Yitzchak's revolution. Let's read the first pasuk. We all know the first pasuk. I didn't even quote the first pasuk. I did. It's verse number one. Eila told us Yitzchak ben Avraham. Here we go. Let's roll up our sleeves. This is Yitzchak's time. Yitzchak's accomplishments. Avraham holeis Yitzchak. Wait a second. We know that. It's not about Yitzchak. We know that Yitzchak was Avram's son. In fact, the word before said, Eila told us Yitzchak ben Avraham. So, this is Yitzchak's life. What did Yitzchak accomplish? Don't tell me about Avraham. Tell me about Yitzchak's accomplishments. Eila told us Yitzchak ben Avraham. He did great things. Imagine one day, if Yirtzeh Hashem had Me'ah V'Esrim, you live a great life, an impactful life, Dr. Zivotofsky type life, you're Talmud Chacham, and you're a professor, and you're the Kaddish name Shamayim, and you live in Israel, and at your hesped at Me'ah V'Esrim, they say, oh, he was so great, his father gave birth to him. Okay, let's all go home, everyone. Hello, what happened to my life and my accomplishments? Eila told us, Yitzchak ben Avram, and if you look at the words, please close the door, Josh, and take a sheet. If you look at the words, the way the pasuk is structured, the word Avram is in jammed. It's called a grammatical shift, where you got two words, Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram holiness Yitzchak, son, father, father, son. So basically, the pasuk is being pivoted on Avram twice. Eila told us Yitzchak ben Avram, Avram, that's the core fulcrum of the pasuk. That's carrying the weight. Avram, this is not about Avram, this is about Yitzchak. Avram's buried already in the Chayisara. We all know that Avram's Maris Machpelah. Why are we talking about Avram again? Well, if we dig a little deeper, we'll find that this is not just the first pasuk of the Parsha. You think about it a little bit more carefully, something's a little bit strange, something's a little bit peculiar about Yitzchak, which forces us to dig a little deeper to really understand the message of Yitzchak. Yitzchak's life is very, very, very boring. Yitzchak's life is very, very humdrum and commonplace. All the excitement of Avram's life and all the excitement of Yaakov's life, meh, not so much with Yitzchak. First of all, what makes Avram's life and Yaakov's life so riveting? Malachi. I have a lot of angels. Yaakov has angels in the beginning of Vayetze and has angels in the end of Vayetze. Avram has angels in Vayera. Not so much with Yitzchak. No angels, no malachim, no supernatural. Okay, well, forget the malachim. There's a lot of milachim. There's a lot of kings in their lives. Avram is visiting the Malkitzedeks and the Avimelechs and the four and the five and the Yaakov with Paro ultimately and Lavan and big face-offs and not so many melachim in Yitzchak's life. Not so much. Well, there are big confrontations and battles and physical violence. That's what brings out the Emunah and the Avos. Avram has to go to war and Yaakov has to battle Esav and the Sarosha. Not that much in Yitzchak's life. Well, there are mizbeachs, a lot of mizbeachs. Avram's building mizbeachs all over the place, and Yaakov is building a mizbeach, and no, not so much. No mizbeachs, no ladders, no dreams. Well, Hashem speaks to you a lot, right? He speaks to you and gives you, speaks to Avram all the time and takes him outside. There, and Hashem speaks to Yaakov and out to your Yaakov, and Hashem doesn't really speak to Yitzchak so much. Well, then you go overseas, right? And you don't speak to Hashem, but you do his bidding and you travel and you change the world. Avram is always out and in, and Yaakov is in and out and in, and well, Yitzchak doesn't really go anywhere. So what is this life of a person without angels and kings and prophecies and promises and mizbeachs and wars? And like, well, okay, well, at least maybe he doesn't have that exciting a life. Let's think about the name. What does the name tell us about the person? Because the names in Bereishis, they're all iconic and they all mean a lot. And we talked about Avram's name and the transition and Yaakov's name and what that meant this week's Parsha. You know why Yitzchak was called Yitzchak? Because when his birth was announced, everyone was laughing. Can I even get my own name? Like, that's why you call me Yitzchak, because the response of the people, could you imagine if your name was, oh, when we found out your mom was pregnant, we had pizza that night, so I called you Pizza. When we found out your mom was pregnant, I don't know, it was a windy night that night, we called you Windy, or Indy, Native. It should be about me. It should be about my name. It's something, Avram, what my role is, what my mission is, and Yaakov, what my struggle with Esav, and I have to try to usurp it from Esav and struggle. Yitzchak's name. Okay, but you know what? In Bereishis, people go through a lot of name changes because they ascend to new mission and new heights, and they change their name from Avram to Avraham, and from Yaakov to Yisrael. And Yosef has three names. By the time you get to Yosef, he's named Yosef and Avrech and Safnas Panech. Everyone's going through a lot. But not Yitzchak. Yitzchak's stuck with the same old name that has nothing to do with his. So something's a little bit fishy here. Yitzchak doesn't have a name that reflects his mission. Yitzchak doesn't go through any drama. Yitzchak doesn't go through any transformation of a name. So who is this boring man who doesn't have name changes and no angels and kings, and what is his message for us? Well, okay, he doesn't have a name, he doesn't have excitement, but at least he has a parsha. So let's study the parsha a little bit. Well, wait a second. How many parshas does he have? A little bit lopsided. How many parshas does Avram have? Three. How many does Yaakov have? That's six. A lot of parshas for Yaakov. Yaakov and his family. Yitzchak, only one. Well, in the parsha, at least he's going to accomplish a lot of things. Even if he's staying at home, he's going to give the brachos. He's going to determine the future. No kings, no, he's a stay-at-home person. But even when you're staying at home, you're going to determine the future, right? Not so fast until you think you're giving a bracha to one person, and it really turns out that everyone around you is choreographing what you're doing. So you're not really even authoring your own parsha. This is Yitzchak's parsha, and the most dramatic event in the parsha is to deliver the brachos and determine the future, right? Not so. Who's really in charge? Rivka, Yaakov, Esav, because Yitzchak's blind. Well, okay, forget the brachos, because by that time he's blind. But what about the part that he really shows his emunah because of the famine and all that struggle, right? Let's read about that. At least we can find who Yitzchak is. If we take everything out, no names and no kings, but at least we'll focus on the famine and the response to the famine and then the struggle with Avimelech for the water. That's going to really show us who Yitzchak is, right? We don't have that much, but at least we can roll up our sleeves and get into that. So let's really focus. Source number Gimel, Vahi Rav Ba'aretz. Okay, now the saga of Yitzchak is beginning. Here's his famine. Milvad Harav Harishon Asher Haya Bimei Avraham. Well, this is not even Yitzchak's famine. It's part two of Avraham's famine. I mean, I'm just imagining Yitzchak, can I even get my own famine? Like, okay, can I just have a famine, please? Like, okay, I don't get my own name change. I don't get any excitement, but give me a famine. Don't call it part two of Avram's famine. Vayhi Rav Baris, Milvada Rav Arishar, Shohaya Bimei Avram. So now Yitzchak is told he shouldn't really travel anywhere. Gur Baris says, oh, Shchon Baris, and he gets, this is his only bracha delivery. These 2 moments before the famine and when he's struggling with Avimelech. This is the only time he speaks to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He says, Yitzchak, you're the one, you're the chosen, you're a tzaddik, you're a kedah man. Why? Because you're Avram's son. He was pretty good because he listened to me. You say, why is it always about Avram? I'm also a tzaddik. Why are you telling me that you're going to protect me in bracha? Ekev asher shama Avram bekoli. And then later in the parsha, during the Avimelech fracas, not when he's traveling to try to solve the hunger, but now he's trying to struggle over the world. This is already Parak Pasuk Chavdalet, 20 psukim later. Hashem tells him, "Don't worry, Vageira Elav Hashem Balailahu." It's at night. Vayomer Elochi Elokei Avraham Avicham. What about just being my Hashem? What about just coming to me? Why is it always Ekev Asher Shama Avram Mikoli Elokei Avraham Avicha? And I'm going to bracha and protect you, Ba'avur Avraham Avdi. What is happening to Yitzchak? He can't get a famine, he can't get a bracha, he can't get a haftacha from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the only time he stands up and does something bold and courageous is when he digs the wells, but the same wells, Vayashev Yitzchak Vayachbar Pasuk Dal, source Dalid. It's in the middle of the parsha, Vayachbar es be'eros ha'mayim m'shechafru b'mei Avram Aviv. He digs the same wells. Okay, but at least call them your own names, right? Naming is pretty important. When you give something a name, you exert your control, you put your stamp on it. Vayikra lehem shemos, kashemos, asher kara lehen Aviv. Calls them the same names that Avram called them. So who is this Yitzchak that he has nothing independent and autonomous about himself? It's no name, no excitement, no transition, no wells, no names, no brachos, no famines, no avtachos. And you know what? Not only that, the only decision he makes on his own in the parsha that Hashem doesn't tell him or that his family doesn't, not manipulate, but basically control, the only decision he makes is, how's he going to solve this threat of Avimelech who may take his life? So he's sitting there thinking, let's see if I can come up with something original. And what's his solution? I got it. Let me say she's my sister. No, let's try that one before. That's going to come as a surprise. Achosihi. Where did you hear that before? So, who is Yitzchak? What is the Torah's message? Not just one little hint here or there. It runs throughout the parsha. Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avram. Avram holiness Yitzchak. We turn into that first pasuk. Avram, Avram. This is Yitzchak's life. He was a child of Avram. Ela told us Yitzchak ben Avram. Avram holiness Yitzchak. Or now, to look at the end, look at the last medrash. Avram Nikra. Avram, source number Vav. Yitzchak Nikra Avraham. The Chassid Ve'ela told us, Yitzchak ben Avraham, Avraham. So I hope you have your attention now. Hope you realize this is something that's worth looking into. Why is it so atypical? Why is it so abnormal? What's Yitzchak's role? And of course, what are we to learn from Yitzchak's role? How does it shape our lives? Well, what's the message of Yitzchak? So the message of Yitzchak evidently is that every revolution of life in any sphere is only as successful as the post-revolutionary entrenchment. Paradigms shift, but sometimes if the sands continue to shift, it becomes a world of quicksand. And every idea gets consumed by the next idea. and too many ideas, and a flurry of ideas, and a flurry of revolutions, and everything's constantly changing, and nothing sticks, and nothing is entrenched, and it happens in almost every sphere of human experience. And I will just describe to you two such spheres in the political sphere, but then we'll talk about some other areas of life, and of course we'll try to make it personal, because we're not here to talk about politics or history. We're here to talk about development, but of course everything is stacked in parallel in life. One of the major differences between the success of the American Revolution and the relative failure of the French Revolution is specifically in this respect, that somehow the American revolutionaries had the capacity to transform into statesmen and diplomats and country builders, whereas the French Revolution never had the post period of allowing ideas to become entrenched. And some of you who study the revolution know that the early revolutionaries became the victims in the later stages of the revolution. Robespierre was guillotined, and Jean-Paul Marat was stabbed famously in his bathtub, the famous portrait. Because the nature of paradigm shifts is you need a period afterwards to turn that revolution, the new paradigm, into commonplace, or else it hasn't settled in. Things have to settle, things have to land, things have to become internalized, they have to become a way of life, they have to become... Sometimes when I talk to people about what Gush means to me, and sometimes people ask me why, I say, well, you may not know it, but Gush really revolutionized the Jewish Orthodox world, and you don't really see some of those ideas as revolutionary, but because Baruch Hashem, they've become commonplace. Hesder today is commonplace. In 1968, when Rav Amital built his yeshiva, it wasn't. It was a revolution. And women's learning today is commonplace. It wasn't when Rav Amital and Rav Lichtenstein started making the laws. And settlements was commonplace. Of course, I live in a settlement. That's a big deal. No, it wasn't commonplace. So many of the ideas that were introduced in this building became commonplace, and once they become successful, they become institutionalized. When they become institutionalized, they become successful. It's just become a revolution, and it's replaced by another revolution. You could claim that the 19th century was an anthropological experiment of failed revolutions. There's just too many ideas entering the human imagination. Communism, socialism, utilitarianism, there's just too many isms. Nationalism, there's just a war of isms. Rather than a slow introduction of a new thought, and that thought becomes entrenched, and that becomes commonplace, and then people start to live that idea. The Netziv of Volozhin has a panoramic manifesto. If you have, I don't know, a couple weeks free, go through the introduction to the Shiltas. About 25 years ago, I was very ill when it, soon after I made Aliyah, I caught like every single bug in Israel, hepatitis and mono. I was just on my back for a month. I couldn't really think. My mind was like a sponge. Not a good way. Like a sponge with holes in it. Was that when you go through Hakdamos to Svarim? So I went through the Netziv's Hakdama to the Shiltas. And his basic point is that Torah goes through cycles. It cycles through different styles of learning. And there are periods of great revolution and innovation. So the 400, 600 year period from roughly 200 BCE till roughly 400 CE was a period of supernova explosion, Chazal, Tanayim, Amarayim. If you gave me a time machine and gave me one dial setting and I could go back to one period in time, that's really at the top of my bucket list, to go back and live with the Tanayim. People who had this mastery of Torah that it hasn't since been equaled, and just to go back and sit next to Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Yochanan and Abaye and Rav and just experience this replacement of supernatural energy with just cognitive energy. They weren't prophets, but they knew Torah so well that they bordered on supernatural knowledge, that they were able to almost recreate the prophetic experience by their mastery of Torah. To go back into that period, what would it be like to sit and learn Torah from Rav Huna, or Rav Chia, or Rebbe? It just, it boggles my mind. And now it's 500, and now you have Gaonim. What did Gaonim write? Not much. What was their Chiddush? Not too much. What was their innovation? They were consolidators. They were anthologizers. They took all of this 600-year period, let's catalog, let's repair the text, Let's collect information. Let's organize. Let's write some tables. Let's take all this information. And now it's the year 1000. You've got these incredible, incredible people living in France, living in Spain, Ramban, Rambam, Rabbeinu Tam, Rashi, Rashba, Ritva, finally, Tosfos Rid, Rama, Rabbeinu Meir Bulefi, and now you hit the 15th century, and you have Rabbi Yosef Cairo and the Ramban, and then all of a sudden, all the innovation stops. Can anyone tell me, you can't, can anyone tell me the most important sefer written on Shas in the 17th century, on Shas? There are great svarim written in the 17th century. They're written on Shulchan Aruch, Taz, and Shachs, late 16th, early 17th, Magen Avraham. You know the most important sefer of the 17th century written on Shas? It's called the Kikayon de Yonah. I think I have the sefer. Because everyone's focus is different. It's collect and thugs. Of course, when the Shach writes, he's writing in a mode of innovation, but his genre is working on the summaries of the Shulchan Aruch that summarize all the Rishonim and try to improve and argue. And of course, his arguing is very creative. It's more creative than some Rishonim, but the whole mindset is for 200 years, collecting, organizing, putting things together. The Marsha, let's take Tosfos and figure out the calculus of Tosfos. How this line interacts with this line, and this line interacts with that line, how the original part of Tosfos makes logical sense with the last part of Tosfos. And now slowly but surely, that wave, which is less than, let's say, the wave of the Gaonim, gives rise to the great period of the Achronim, the late 18th century, of course, the 19th century, Reb Chaim and his Talmidim. I believe we are living through a period in which innovation is not that important anymore. What are the two most important svarim written in the 20th century? What's the most important sefer of the 20th century? Art scroll. Clearly, art scroll. Before art scroll was Steinsaltz, and before Steinsaltz was Kehati. And all the similar svarim. Accessorizing, creating access, organizing, tables, pictures of Erevin. We don't need people to reinvent the Reb Chaim wheel right now. We need people to teach the methodology, to create tables and flowcharts and information and collection. And it's true in every sphere of human experience. And it was truest when Avram revolutionized the world. You don't realize how new these ideas were. Like one HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's responsible for good and evil, light and dark, day and night, fire, water, war, peace. This was a great period of paganism. There were angry gods, angry birds in Shemayim, warring with one another. How can we win their favor? How can we bribe them? How can we sacrifice some virgins to them? I'm hungry. Well, can you eat an animal? Can you eat a human? Well, okay, whatever. I'll kill you. I'll murder you. Who cares? Morality. Why should it be moral? What does morality have to do with anything? Survival of the fittest. I have to defend myself from brontosauruses and tyrannosaurus rex. I'll kill you. Avram spoke about a one HaKadosh Baruch Hu you couldn't see, but you still had a relationship with, that created the world, that was kind and compassionate. It blew people's minds. Mind blown. It was blowing their minds. And it slowly took form and slowly took momentum, but there's a medrash that says, someone just actually emailed me, an adult emailed me this week, he asked me this question. There's a medrash that says that all the Gerim that Avram and Sarah converted as a Nefesh HaShasur Bachar and Chazur L'Surah. Because where did all these Jews go? Where did all these people go? By the time you reach Parshas Vayigash, how many Jews are there? Still 70. What happened to all the hordes of people, the mega church of Avram? So there are different answers to that question, but it wasn't always successful. It was one step forward, one step back, two steps back. People were learning new ideas. They were trying to unlearn 2,000 years of human history. Trying to unlearn 2,000 years of human history, not so easy. Which brings us to Yitzchak. And Yitzchak can either be the person that says, well, I can't live in anyone's shadow. I need excitement and innovation and revolution and Che Guevara, and I need to hold my hand up and change the world and be on the headlines. Or I can be a hero in a different way. by just locking in ideas and living ideas and repeating ideas and calling the same names and digging the same wells, literally digging and trenching into the ground. And I don't need name changes. I don't need angels. I don't need anything new. I just need to play my role. Close the door, please. I just need to play my role in history. And if it's boring, then it's boring. Because sometimes in life, to be successful, you have to learn to live with boredom. If you're constantly living from adventure to adventure, then you're basically going to invite mediocrity. Real excellence in life, real excellence is repeating every day the same steps, the same. Ask anyone. 10,000 hours. You really want to be successful in life. You really want to be successful. And you're starting to realize this when you come to yeshiva, because the excitement and the afterglow of the first couple of months is now starting to die out. And now it's a little bit harder to come to the base medrash every day, day in, day out. What's tomorrow? Same as yesterday. What's going to be the next day? Same as tomorrow. So you have to have this vision and say, well, wait a second. If I string hundreds of these days together, then maybe one day I'll be a Talmud Chacham. And maybe one day I'll be serious as an Oved Hashem. But it's going to take many, 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 many days. And each day is going to take many, 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 many hours. And do I have the vision and the discipline to pull that off? Without the vision, it's very hard to create it. Some people don't have vision. And therefore, like, why am I doing this? Why am I coming to the base matters to learn? It's not exciting. It's not meaningful in the immediate sense. And some people really do have vision. Well, I know that if I do this day in, day out, I'll get there. But just they lose it in the execution gap. If you ask me, yeah, I know. If I did it, I could accomplish something, but, you know, I'm not used to that. I'm used to a little this and a little of that, a little YouTube and a little seminar and a little this club, and that was really what your high school was, like a patchwork, like a tablecloth of patchwork, this club and this class and that class. And now, can I just have that focus to come into the base medrash and spend 12, 13 hours a day, 6 days a week or 5 days a week? Well, that's not something I'm normally accustomed to. And that's the heroism of Yitzchak. He doesn't have to reinvent the wheel. And he doesn't need the headline. He doesn't need to have on his tombstone all of his accomplishments. And we'll talk about this a little bit ironically with Esav. We'll try to contrast Yitzchak and Esav if we have a little bit of time left in the shir. Now, what does this have to do with you and your development? I've already started to hint towards it. But your life has a little bit of Avram in it and a little bit of Yitzchak in it. And when I say your life has a little bit of Avram and a little bit of Yitzchak in it, I mean there are stages in life that are more Avram-like, and there are stages in life that are more Yitzchak-like. But additionally, in every experience, there has to be an Avram part of you and a Yitzchak part of you, not just what part of your life you're in. You could claim that right now, most of you find yourself more in an Avraham phase. And it's really an exciting phase to be part of. It's really an exciting part of life. To be honest, I don't mean to say this in a false fashion. I'm jealous of you. I remember when I was your age at this stage in life. It's a really exciting time to live. Because you're forging your identity. You're discovering new people. You're discovering new ideas and hopefully new ideals. You're patching together. It's really a chance to spread your wings and to grow. This is when you forge identity. By 27, 28, you're pretty much finished. Obviously, you change and you continue to grow, but these are the 10 years or so where you're starting to become who you'll be for the rest of your life. But you know what? Some people never have the capacity to shift into Yitzchak. You know what I call those people? I call them the Peter Pans. Peter Pans, in a bad way. They just can't take those ideas and lock them in. They can't shift from being 22 to being 32 or 42. And it's always movement and change and looking for new, and then they hit midlife crisis and the red Maserati. And people of real success are able to say, this is the identity I found, and now let me just lock it. That's what marriage is about. Marriage is really about being the same person. That's what being a father is about. Can you be the same person for your kids day in, day out? Can you show up even-keeled, same emotion, the world around you is a hurricane, and you're just ground zero. You're just the platform. Everyone around you is stressed, and everyone around you is full of hormones and full of pressure, and you're just, you know what, same mood, same person, same schedule. By the way, it's a secret of raising your children as well. One day you have little children at home. Well, my best advice as a parent has nothing to do with how enlightened you are, nothing to do with how much communication you have, all these fancy, you know what it has to do with? Make sure your kids from the age of 2 to the age of 12 go to sleep the same time every night within 20 minutes. I promise you, you have good kids that way. Because if you make them crazy, because that's when they're being wired. Kids just need stability. My wife and I were makbid within half an hour range. They went to sleep the same time every night. Except for our younger kids, and we spoiled them. ran out of juice. But for the older kids, we did a pretty good job. Okay, 7:30 came, they were in bed. Because they had to get their wiring together. It was just a question of, it wasn't enlightened parenting. It was just getting them sleep they needed on the schedule they needed. Just continuity, consistency. And so you have to make sacrifices. Of course, they sacrifice. We want to be out. We have some place to go. We have our mitzvah to go. We're wedding to go. Okay, get a babysitter. One person stays home. It's just about consistency. Will you have the ability in life? Can you embrace the boredom? There's a word for boredom in modernity. It's called existential boredom. Sounds French. Ennui. E-N-N-U-I. Man has a hard time facing boredom. Because the flip side of boredom is looking at your identity, and that's hard for people. So we live in the great age of distraction. It's called entertainment. We can just entertain ourselves endlessly, video on demand, endless entertainment, game after game, movie after movie, action after action, news item after news item, Instagram after Twitter feed after Twitter feed. Essentially, we can avoid the mirror. We can avoid identity. We can avoid actually sitting in a corner and thinking about who we are, who we'd like to be. When's the last time you did that? When's the last time you actually sat in a corner, by yourself, and thought for 15 minutes straight? Well, hopefully you're starting to get the muscles for that in the base manage because you're actually thinking about a Gemara or a Tosfos, hopefully for 15 minutes straight. Try to take that muscle that you're developing and use that muscle for identity. Sit in a corner or sit by yourself and say, I really want to think about myself. Who am I? What do I want to become? What will it take to be that? Am I courageous enough to make that decision? Do I have the discipline to see through the decision? What will it mean tomorrow? When's the last time I failed to do it? How do I feel after I fail? I feel better after I succeed. Let me try to succeed. Actually think and go through yourself and process yourself without the fingers and the clicking and the, because that will take you out of it. But even now, as I'm hinting to, even now is a period which feels a lot more like Yitzchak. Elul felt like Avraham. There's really new challenges coming to Israel. There's a lot. I hate to say it, but I say this every year. I don't know how this lands this year, but your year is almost over. As crazy as it sounds, there are two periods of your year. There's the two-month period till Hanukkah, Cheshvan and Kislev, and then we break for Hanukkah, and the break, it feels like a break because there's Chazara session. And then there's about a two-and-a-half-month period till Purim. Once Purim time comes, things go sideways pretty quickly. There's Purim and the Purim break in Poland. Again, I don't know what's going to happen this year, but I mean, it's going to be worse, not better, in terms of the ability to keep things together. And in the summer, people leave in the summer. Americans leave in the summer. So stop waiting for the year to begin and for the intensity. If you're not generating momentum and intensity now, you'll find your year slipping pretty quickly through your fingers. Then you wake up and it's June, and what happened? What happened to my year in Israel? That's why people say Shana Ben. We're not so upset about that. Oh, we say Shana Ben, because like, obviously not, but seriously, stop waiting. This is really a good time, a good gut check. That's what I'll talk a little bit about tonight, like where are we? A really good gut check to say, okay, am I pushing myself? Am I translating? Is it just intellectual, cerebral? Am I growing as a person? Again, don't panic. Oh my goodness, I'm not. Let me throw myself off a hill, but it's a good chance to really think about these questions. And I'm happy that some of you are starting to think in some of my conversations with people. I see that you're thinking about them. Again, don't get panicky, but never panic, but try to address them. Well, how can I? Instead of saying, oh my goodness, I'm not saying, well, how can I? Give me a tool. How can I be more this? How can I improve here? Give me some advice. Give me a suggestion. Because we've been through thousands of these stories. Very little of what we're seeing is new, not in any way depersonalized. Obviously, for you, it's a new person. We've seen these movies before. We go through it every year, so We have tactics that generally work. It's just a question of employing those tactics. Anyway, that's the saga of Yitzhak. And every year, hopefully, that you read Yitzhak, it's a good gut check to see, how am I doing on the Yitzhak Avram balance, like an acid-based balance, acid pH? You want to see how the pH is. You want to try to get as close to 7 as possible. So you want to make sure, okay, there's a lot of newness, especially the next 10 years where there's a lot of newness in your life. Just make sure, okay, how's the minion doing? How's the learning doing? How's the storm doing? How's the day-to-day doing? Am I just running around living life like Avram? Then maybe very little is sinking in. Are there parts of me that feel more like Yitzchak? Are there at least parts of my life that feel more like Yitzchak? Then it's a healthy pH. Mirtz Hashem in 10 years, in 12 years, come back to this and say, okay, now I'm married, Baruch Hashem, Ezra Hashem, and I have a family, and I have a job, and you know, maybe it isn't such a wise idea to be, finish the sentence, running after the great. Maybe I should allow myself to be 30 years old, not 20 years old. And what's the difference between being 30 years old and 20 years old? I know it sounds like a long time off, but I'm trying to give you the language and the voice inside your head that when these things happen, you'll be able to one of the biggest challenges of, let's say, your age now till 35-ish, 40-ish, is when you stop making decisions and you just let life control the decisions for you. Okay, because there's a lot of ways that life will make decisions for you. And then you wake up after you're 40 or 50, wait a second, I didn't really make the decision that just, you know, in continuing what the person spoke today, the American spoke about. Let's say, for example, here's a way for you not to control your decision, okay? Because you want to make a living, you're bright enough to make a living, you're bright enough to go to a good college. So if this is your arc for the next 10 years without making a decision, then you haven't really lived your life. Now, if you make that decision, you know what you're getting into. I'm not judging anyone's decisions, but if you spend a year, 2 years, so then you go back to a college and you take the LSATs because you never really find yourself being attracted. And you're smart enough to be a great lawyer. Like everyone in this room is, ho-hum, great accomplishment. Okay, and then all of a sudden you go to a top law school because, and you live on the west side because that's where singles live. And then you go to a fancy law school and then you sign a big contract to work for hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. And then you pay a price to your family. Then you're if you make that choice, say, I want to be that for the following reasons. And I know the problems and I know the challenges, but that's the life I'm choosing. That's fine. Every lifestyle could be heroic. Every lifestyle could be mediocre, depending on, or not mediocre, but authored for you or de-authored. But a lot of people just, they don't make decisions. It's just because I know I want a lot of money and people are showering with money and it feels prestigious to be this way. Just make a decision. Just sit there and think about what are you getting into? How are you forging your identity? And are you balancing between the Avram and Yitzchak parts? And then as long as you're making a decision based on ideals and based on values, it's your decision. No one's going to indoctrinate your decision. But I find a lot of people, they just don't make decisions. They just let the world take control of their decisions for them. Okay, we have 15 minutes left. Let's talk a little bit about Esav. Okay? If you asked before you leave, okay, sports fans will love to tell you the worst trade in history. The worst trade in the NFL. The worst trade in basketball ever. And most often, worst trade in the football league. More often, it's about their own team trade. Oh, my team made a terrible trade. Oh, yeah, the worst trade ever. So some of you are not into sports. So you're more into history. What's the worst trade in history? What? Oh, okay. don't steal the punchline. Worst trade in history, unrelated to Parshas Tovos. What? What do you say?
It won't be an exchange.
I think it would probably be Manhattan Island, 1626. $24. Get you a lot of real estate for $24. Okay, and they probably didn't happen, but at least urban legend has it. The island of Manhattan went for 24 trinkets to the Dutch company. But as Reuben ruined my punchline, Parshas Toldos contains a whammy of a trade. Let's see, Bechor, legacy, spearhead of history, chosen people, being a Kohen, chili. Okay. Which one's it gonna be? I want the chili. Why? Who in the right mind? What's he thinking? What's he saying? Like, if I told you I had that one dial on the history machine, on the time machine, to go back to the Tanaim, if I could ask one person in history one question, I want to interview Esav and say, Esav, what were you thinking? So the answer is, I really wouldn't have to ask him because he tells us. Vayomer Esav. Hine anochi, source number 2, part Aleph, holech lamos, v'lama zeli bechora. Let's talk about 2 meanings of what he says, and then a 3rd meaning of nothing he says, but it's pretty obvious from the lifestyle he chose, and this gets us back to Yitzhak. One reason Esav makes this terrible trade, this horrendous, horrendous, tragic trade, is because he's looking through his own mortality. He says, I'm going to die. Whatever I accomplish, it's pointless. I'm just an infinitesimal speck of cosmic dust. I will accomplish, but everything I accomplish will be rolled back by the sands of time. Every president, whatever important, it's all just mortal. All the water in the rivers, they go to the sea. Wait, when did I hear that before? Kalamayim. Esav is studying Koheles. And have all of Olimakolava. What is human beings accomplish? What do I have to accomplish in this world? 100 years, 120 years, maybe a little longer in those days, 170 years, but do I really have an impact in this large cosmic reality? Can I really change anything? Maybe I should get the chili. Maybe I should have a good meal. What do I hope to accomplish? And the answer to Esav's question is, well, you're right. If you look at yourself as a point, independent of anyone else around you, maybe because you spend your whole life hunting, so you live in that world, it can be very depressing. You could be very despairing. You could be Albert Camus, who came to the conclusion that you have to be mad not to commit suicide. French writer, mid-20th century. Sorry, I've got to educate you guys. But if you feel you're part of something larger, a lineage, a parade, an orchestra of humanity, people that came before you, people that came after you, you're adding something, you're reinforcing theirs, you're paving the way for others. So, lo lachem lacha ligmor, you're not going to finish anything. You're just a small part of it, but you're part of something else. You're part of something larger. Those are some of the ideas we're trying to convey to you here in Yeshiva. You're part of something larger. You're here in this country. People have dreamed of this country for thousands of years, and here you are. People have died so that you can sit in this building. People are now, currently, people like you are sitting out in freezing, cold guard booths, watching the northern border, watching the road. So don't complain if you're a little cold, or if dinner tonight you get 2 less bowls of falafel. Or you're part of something larger, and you're part of something larger Torah-wise. People have been discussing Arev and Eved Kanani, real people, smart people, not people who had little to do with their time, people who could have out-Newton, could have out-Michelangelo. But they decided they wanted to spend their entire life thinking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, trying to understand Hashem's will as best they can. Then when they get up to Shemayim and everything around this fades, and the only thing that's left is Hashem's will, you know what? They'll have a little bit of a head start. And now you're part of that. So grow up in a good way and live a life that's a little bit more resonant than just what are my needs and how am I more comfortable and what's the easy path and how could I be happy tonight when I go to sleep? And if that entails a little struggle, teeny weeny little struggle, like getting up tomorrow when it's a little cold. Oh, I'm so sorry. You have to get up tomorrow at 6:30. A lot of people go through and went through a lot worse. And if you see yourself in league with them, then your life really does matter. I made that decision a long, long time ago when I could have stayed. I'm not in any way presenting that as the only decision, but it was my decision. says that I'm going to intentionally accomplish less in my life because my career arguably could have been better and more effective in America because I want to be a road paver. Road paver? Yeah, I wanted to pave the way for my children and their descendants to live in Israel. And I thought that could be better served by picking up lock, stock, and barrel in 1993 and moving to Alon Shvot rather than staying in Manhattan. And that in no way devalues people who make another decision to stay in Manhattan or in Johannesburg or in Melbourne and to try to change history that way. But it's a pity. Esav's really sad. Hinenochi olech lamos. Because you can look at the limitations of human experience and feel inadequate and feel crippled and handicapped and fall into despair and become a Camus and become suicidal, chas v'shalom. Or you can say, you know what, I'm part of something. I'm part of humanity, I'm part of Am Yisrael, I'm part of the Masara. What's my part? What's my chelek in Torah? The same chelkenu v'sara secha. What's your chelek in Torah? When this is all finished, what will your chelek? Take the word Torah and make it a little more general. What's your chelek in the grand march of humanity and the grand march of the Jewish people, which of course is the same, and Hashem expects you to march as a Jew so that you can lead humanity. And even if you change a little, you'll make a great change. If anyone walks out of the shir and says, you know what, I was particularly inspired by Ritarik and said, I'm going to work really, really, really hard to raise my family as Yirei Shemayim and Ovdei Hashem and people that know a little bit of Torah, I'm going to be a cornerstone of my community, and I'm gonna breathe. You're a Shemayim, and I'm gonna be the one in Shul with Davins quietly. And just make a bucket list of what it would take to be the super champion Balabas. Like make a list of 10 values. You know, easy. Like what are the 10 values you wish you would have seen in the people that you grew up with? And that takes a lot of work to reach that. A lot of work now, a lot of discipline down the line. But that you're a star in my book. Because you'll just be a beacon for some young boy or young girl in 15, 20 years who's trying to find their way. And the more adults you see who are serious-minded about religion, about Avodas Hashem, just the more... And who knows? You could be the influence of the next Gadol HaDor. Next Gadol HaDor, when he writes his book in 2120, he'll say, oh, when I was growing up in Queens or something, I saw some, you know, Balabas who... His name was, fill in the blank, it would be your name. So it's not about you. It's not about the 80 years or 100 years you spent on this world, but how can you change it? How can you renovate it? It should be empowering, not crippling. It should be exciting, not despairing. So that's Esav's first mistake. Rashi believes that Esav commits a second error. Rashi says that when Esav says, Hineh anochi holech lamos, he's not thinking about human mortality that we'll all reach. Me'ayin basa lana toholech. It's something else. He's saying, well, let me size up this offer, this Bechor business. Let me size it up. I'm paraphrasing Rashi. You can read Rashi. I can be a Bechor. I can serve as a pseudo-Kohen, because that's what the Bechor is served as. But you know what? There's a lot of pain involved in being a Kohen. A lot of punishment. It's very precarious. It's very, very penalizing. A lot of P's. If I make the wrong step, I got to learn Seder Kutchin. Esav wasn't learning Kohelis. He was learning Seder Kutchin. Got to worry about Pigol and Nosar and Tomei and Yotzei and Misa B'nei Shemayim and Truma. Truma's Revila. It's a lot here. And if I step the wrong way, I could be none of it of you. Hinenochi olech lamos, this is going to kill me. This Bechor business, it's going to kill me. I don't need it. It's all just pain. Thunderbolts, lightning, just penalties and punishments. And I don't need that. I need an easy life. And there's Esav's error. Because, guys, that is not what Avodas Hashem is. You know what Avodas Hashem is? Here is what it is. Nobility, glory, majesty, transcendence, leaving this world and encountering HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Bumping yourself up into an entirely different league. You can play in the minors, or you can play in the majors. You know what playing in the minors is? Everything here. Everything you see. Everything in the newspapers. Prime Minister, that's called playing in the minors. President, you're the MVP of the minor league. You're the MVP of the WNBA. You want to play in the majors? Here's the majors. HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Eternity. Olam Haba. That's the majors. Now, to protect and preserve the gravitas of that, there's consequence. Because when you're involved in something really empowering, there's going to be consequences. In the major leagues, there's consequences. Minor leagues, commit an error, no one's going to know about it. Major leagues, you commit an error, let's see who can follow the cultural reference. You'll be Bill Bucknerized. You'll be Bill Buckner. Look it up. You'll be Bucknerized. Because you'll lose the series because it'll go right through your legs. So you make a choice. Do you want to play in the majors? There could be consequences. But don't get fixated upon the consequences. That's what religion is, punishment and onish. No, religion is like HaKadosh Baruch Hu giving you the opportunity, and a Kohen and a Bechor, a special opportunity, to stand in the Beis HaMikdash and to facilitate Avodas Hashem for others by Korbanos. Do you want that opportunity? Do you have the shoulders large enough to brace that responsibility? Life of responsibility and consequence, life of ramification, is just the flip side of a life of opportunity and majesty and splendor and power and glory. One doesn't come without the other. And my saddest moments as a mechanech, my saddest moments as a mechanech, when I think of all the people I wasn't able to be successful with, and it's crushing. It's crushing. I'm not going to travel this year, but when I travel, and who likes traveling to L.A.? I love traveling. It's nice and warm. Who likes traveling to all these planes in Australia? I think the following, once heard the Panavizhar Rav, they asked him, because he traveled a lot when he built Panavizhar. He traveled around collecting nickels and dimes. My Zaidi accompanied him, so my Zaidi told me stories. He used to sleep on park benches because they couldn't afford hotels in the open air. And someone once asked the Panavizhar Rebbe, why all this travel? He says, you know what? A rotzach b'shogeg. What's the onesh of a rotzach b'shogeg? Let's go to Galus. And every mechanech is a rotzach b'shogeg. Because you try your hardest to try to change people's lives, but it doesn't always succeed. With every fiber of my being, I hope that everyone in this room becomes an Oved Hashem, and Yirei Shamayim. I hope. I don't know, if someone came in with a hatchet, I'd cut off my right arm if I knew that every single boy that I ever taught, I don't need an arm, I have two arms. But if every single boy that I could ever teach would be a Yirei Shamayim and see him in Olam Haba, when I don't need arms anymore, it'd be great. Olam Haba is one big coronavirus hug. We don't have to use arms in Olam Haba, we just see each other. But I wouldn't trade that life. Some people are afraid to be parents, because maybe I'll fail. Afraid to have a relationship, maybe I'll fail. Failure means you're taking great, great opportunity. And if you're always haunted by failure, then you'll never seize opportunity. Some people are crippled by it, by fear of failure. And in religion, that fear of failure, that is a fear of failure, but fear of punishment and repercussion. But it's not about repercussions. It's not a bechor is. Bechor is he's thinking about what opportunities I can serve. How can I serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And all Esav thinks about is hinei anochi olech lamos. It's all about punishment and misipidei shamayim and the karis. He's got religion wrong. You have to mature in the way you view Avodas Hashem. It's not about tzchar and onesh, guys. It has to be something more integral, more inherent, more implicit. If Hashem came to you, some of you have heard this from me, so I apologize if you heard it before, but if you haven't, it's really important to hear it. If Hashem came to you tonight in a dream and said, you know what, Shlomo, since you're looking at me, take the night off. Take tomorrow off. Tomorrow starting at 6 a.m. Thursday 6 a.m. to Friday 6 a.m. 24 hours off. No ramifications. No onesh. No schar. Let it rip. What we call the Gush Rumspringer. Like the Amish have a Rumspringer. This will be the Gush Rumspringer. 24 hours. No schar. No onesh. Do what you'd like. Touch. Eat. Behave. Here's a jet plane. Go wherever you want. No corona. You're free. Do whatever you want. What would you say? Okay? That's honest. But when you reach religious maturity, there's only one answer. And you're on the path. And part of the path to that is honesty. Obviously, you need that. When you finally get there, your answer's no. There's not a part of my life that I see as a surrender of my experience that I'll punch my ticket to the next world. You know, if you told me there's no world, which is the same thing as the dream, no next world, I won't change a thing. I get up tomorrow, speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, try to study his will, try to raise my family, try to build his country, try to change the world, try to live my life as morally as I can. And if you told me it all ended in 120 years, I won't change. I'd do the exact same thing. Because I know what life would be like without it. And that's when you reach religious maturity, when Hashem's will and your will starts to synchronize. You know, say, oh, it's Hashem's will and I'm suffocating and I hate it, I can't think about it. I've got to hold out for as long as I can because if I fail, I know the consequences. Sulfuric ash and hot fire, I don't want that. And I know what's waiting for me in Olam Haba, 72 virgins, I want that. No. You know what Olam Haba is? It's gush. Without your body, without being tired, without Yetzer Hara, it's whatever spirituality you have in this world without any impediments. No virgins, no food, no burgers bar, no super saw, no cell phones, no sports. It's something like this. So, Olam Haba isn't a reward. It is a result. It is an extension of how you've developed spiritually in this world. And that's when you're ready to roll religiously. You're ready to roll religiously when you pass that Rubicon. When you say, you know what, it's not about, I wish I would now. And you have to be honest with yourself, because if you just tell yourself the tale, you're not going to grow. How can I get to the point where I realize it's not about suffocating myself in this world just to punch my dick? Not about that. It's about realizing the glory of this world and the glory of this life. When I left yeshiva, I went to Rav Aaron and I wanted to thank him. And I said, remember, I got up the guts to say, I said, Rebbe, Chazal tells us you have to thank your Rebbe, your father, for bringing you into this world and your Rebbe for bringing you into Olam Haba. I want to thank you for bringing me into Olam Hazeh as well. Because the type of Avodas Hashem you showed me was not about holding your breath. Moshe, sit down, please. Holding your breath until you get to the next world. It was about having the best Olam Hazeh I could have, the best life in this world that I could have. And I saw a type of lifestyle that finally taught me this is the type of life I want. It's noble, it's educated, it's enlightened, it's sensitive, it's compassionate, it's selfless, it's like who I want to be. And I never realized I could be. So let's take a break because some guys are coming in. Ellie said we're going to have a little bit of a town meeting, town hall, discuss things a little bit. That's the second of Asaph's mistakes. We're not going to get to the third of Asaph's mistakes, but just to summarize, the first mistake is I'm going to die. Yeah. Newsflash. You're all going to die. And coronavirus has reminded us of that. Live with that and say, how can I live with that and see myself as part of something larger? Second part is, don't think religion's about suppression and punishment. It's about glory, but there's a gravitas to it. And the gravitas is reflected by the fact that there are consequences. So either you're spooked by consequence and spooked by failure, or say, you know what? I have confidence in myself. And confidence in the Kodesh Baruch Hu's rachamim, and I'm going to take this on. Okay, let's take a 2-minute break, and then we'll talk a little tomorrow.